Station number 12578, Rule 3.
Mr. Hall, Rule 3.
Bringing to the attention of the mess secretary that certain civilians were using the officer's mess as a cheap canteen. This worried me for a bit until the next suggestion was somebody who had written in, "Good God, and this from an Australian." We never heard any more about it, as you can imagine. Also, I had two interesting flights backwards and forwards from London to Edinburgh. I remember I was going from London to Edinburgh, and one of the Air Force officers involved in this activity was from headquarters in London, was a Wing Commander Rogers, who was too old for active flying. But he had been a flyer. And he said, I can remember, I can still see him say, "Peter," he said, "I'll fly up to anywhere. We'll go together and I'll fly up." Because he loved to go flying. It wasn't an active flyer, but any opportunity he wanted to go. So he went down to Northolt Airport, aerodrome, where he had organised a Lysander, which is a very strange old aeroplane. And when he got, I sat in the back, and he got into it, and he looked at it, and he saw all these knobs and controls and things, and I could still see him. He shouted over the side, "Sergeant, tell me what all these things do," you see. This made me a little nervous about our flight, as you can imagine. However, I thought he's a very experienced man, and the sergeant said to him, "You don't want to bother about any of these things, sir. There's just this wheel down here you must remember about. That wheel, down by your right hand, winds a weight down into the tail for taxiing. And it's down there now. And before you take off, you must wind that wheel so that the weight is brought forward. If you don't, when you take off, you'll just do a loop at ground level." So he shouted back, "Peter, remind me to wind the weight forward." So that was all right. We took off. That was fine. And he soon learnt to fly it once we were in the air. But he threw all the maps over his shoulder at me and said, "I can't fly this damn thing and navigate. You navigate, you see." Well, of course, we got lost. But we did see an airfield. So he said, "Let's land there and ask where we are." And that's another memorable event. We landed all right. But there was no way that dear Wing Commander Rogers could taxi this aeroplane. Whatever he did, we shot off in a different direction, because it was not like modern aeroplanes with brakes and things. It was very, very tricky. So he said, "Get out and hold the tail and point me in the right direction and run behind." So that's what I had to do until we got running behind the aeroplane, hung onto the tail and pointing it in the right direction to the control tower, who were very surprised to find a Wing Commander get out. And they got the fire engine ready just in case and all that sort of stuff. But he was a very senior officer, so all was well. And they told us where we were. We had a pee and off we went. That was an eventful trip. Another one coming home, I flew home in a Defiant. And I remember the young pilot, when we got in, I said, "Where are we going?" I said, "Down to Northolt." He said, "Well, I don't know the way." I said, "Well, it's south, isn't it?" I said, "You just fly straight south." And so we just flew straight south. I just fly. And he said, "Until we hit the barrage balloons in London." Right. So we flew down to the barrage balloons in London, and when they got dangerously near, we turned a bit right and went to Northolt. Then, of course, came the great day when, should we use this in anger? So we took the flight, these three aircraft, down to the south, and I've forgotten which airfield they were going to fly from, but I installed myself at the in the control room at group headquarters. It was either Bentley Priory or at Stanmore. I can't remember which it was. One of the group control, the group control headquarters anyway. And we sent these three airplanes off. And we knew that they would look like, four or five squadrons of aircraft, as far as the Germans were concerned, on their radar. and we wonder what would happen. And what happened was exactly as we expected and we hoped. The Germans put so many fighters in the air. The Germans put a whole lot of fighters in the air, and we knew everything was working well. We then got a little fearful as to what would happen when they saw that there was just three Defiants, and so we immediately told the Defiants to come down to ground level, or sea level, and fly back at sea level, which they did. So we knew then that this system worked. We handed it over to the RAF, and it was used for a long, long time. The Germans knowing about it, knowing we were using it, but of course they never knew whether we were or not, which meant that it was a way of, for instance, we'd send these things over, get all the German fighters airborne, get them using up petrol, send the Defiance home, and then we would send over a real raid, and the Germans would be, if not out of petrol, jolly nearly out of petrol, and give our boys an easy time, because the Germans would have to land.
You started working on this in 1942, I think you said.
Yeah.
Was it soon after you started working on it that this test was mounted?
Oh, blah, 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 blah. It couldn't have been very long. It couldn't have been very long.
A matter of months.
Yes, it would be a matter of months. Well, the test flights were in June 1942. The test flights were in June 1942. That's when we were up at Dreux. Then incidentally, jumping ahead, and perhaps I'll come to that later, that same equipment was used during the invasion. I'll tell you about that in a minute. However, the other things we were doing then was, of course, we were concerned with, as the years went by, we were concerned with protecting, basically. All our work was trying to protect the bomber force. Now, you know, there's been lots of arguments lately about Bomber Harris and all that, but the fact was, whether the rights or wrongs of it, the bomber force could continue night after night only if the attrition rate was down to something like 3% or at the most 4%. And when you think about it, that's a pretty horrendous loss rate of 4%. We certainly couldn't stand 5%. 1 in 20 crews disappearing, an aircraft disappearing. If that went on too long, you just could not keep it up. And so we spent an awful lot of time and effort and big teams of people in protecting the bomber force in every way we could and keeping the attrition rate down. And we did that by all sorts of jamming equipment. Jamming equipment in every bomber, jamming equipment in special jamming aircraft, which were part of a 100 group, and detecting equipment, which I didn't have anything to do with actually, that was another guy, equipment which would actually detect enemy fighters behind you, detect their radar, such that a little light came on. A close friend of mine did this. A little light came on in front of the pilot if an enemy airborne radar was heard, which meant he was on your tail. So a red light came on and he tried to do something about it. And so on. All sorts of equipment. The ones I was mostly concerned with were a big jamming a jammer called Mandrel, which was for jamming the big Freya 120 megacycle stations, and the jamming of the Wurzburg radar, another one, the 50 centimeter ones, the ones we got back from Brunbar, and so on.
What were the main problems you had in working on Mandrel?
Mandrel was there were various ways of jamming, and the most satisfactory one, we thought at the time, and I think probably it's still true, is to actually radiate noise. Now, by noise we mean real electronic noise, not just bangs. We mean genuine, what was called white noise, which is equally distributed background noise. Like when you have the background noise on your radio, that's white noise. And if it gets too much, you can't hear the speech or whatever. So we needed to generate a lot of noise. Now, you know, when you have a receiver, you generally try to get rid of noise, and noise is an awful nuisance. You find when you try and actually make noise, make enough to really 100% modulate a transmitter, it's jolly difficult to make enough noise. And eventually we found a very noisy device called an electron multiplier, which was made by RCA, an RCA 931 tube. And this sort of, this was a vacuum tube which had sort of electronic amplification within itself, an electron multiplier, and as such amplified itself, the noise of its own cathode, if you like. And this was very good. And then you say, what problems do we have with these things? Well, one problem was with this tube, because all of a sudden it didn't work. And why didn't it work? Well, RCA had noticed that we were importing an awful lot of these, and they thought it must be very important to the British war effort. So they put a big effort into reducing its noise. So this great improvement, as they were concerned, actually ruined it as far as we were concerned. We had to go back to them and say, undo all that good work you've done. That was one problem. Not many other problems with it, really, I think. There was always problems of production and aerials and getting them installed and all those sorts of straightforward problems. There were so many different and ongoing changes, different things we did, and ongoing changes by the enemy, and new developments by the enemy. We had to keep on developing new things, not just Mandrel. There were other things, Diner, and where I can't remember very much about, and so I don't suppose I had a lot to do with them. But there was a lot of effort going in, and eventually so much effort that there was a special group called a 100 group set up in Bomber Command, largely to handle the protection of the bomber force. And the protection of the bomber force by a 100 group included fighters that escorted the bomber group, but mostly it was carrying all this jamming equipment and doing all the spoofing as well. And of course it included, by this time, although it's nothing to do with me, the throwing out a window. But window was a subject of a great debate. It wasn't to do with me, but we knew all about it. It was to whether or not we should use it. Because there again, that's one of those things which is very obvious. It's absolutely devastating from the point of view of radar. If we used it, they would use it. So, you know, was it worth risking? Now, one mildly amusing story about all that. I remember going up to Oulton, Oulton. There was an airfield up there, which is somewhere up in Lincolnshire or South Yorkshire, somewhere up there.
Is it near Lowestoft?
Near Lowestoft, that's right. I think
Oulton
you're
Broad.
It's somewhere up there. Anyway, I don't know whether you realise that in those days, driving about England was jolly difficult, but we all got used to it. Because driving about England was difficult, first of all, because there were no signposts, so you never knew where you were, so you had to map read. And if you were driving at night, there was no light, you know, and you had no street lights, obviously, and the headlights of your car were all shuttered down. So it was all very difficult. So everybody, sensibly, gave everybody a lift. And if you got to somewhere and you could pick up someone who knew the way to somewhere, then you were in good form. So I had to take some equipment and to Alton. I'm not certain it's Alton Broads, but it's that part of the, up that part up there. And it was a miserable night. Wet. And by the time I got up there, driving up from Morpham in a car that wouldn't do more than about 40 miles an hour anyway, it's an old 1930 Riley 9 I had, I picked up a couple of guys. I said, I'm going to there. They said, oh, we know exactly where that is. We'll show you the way. And so, fine, I said. They got in the pouring wind. Off we drove. Very, very nice guys. Here we are. This is where we get out. I said, well, where the bloody hell are we? They say, well, I don't know where you're going, but we were going to Lowestoft Docks, and here we are. And just left, abandoned me. And I then had to find this damn place. And there is more than one Alton. I'm not certain it was Lowestoft, by the way. And I eventually found an Alton, which was the wrong one. But there was an aerodrome there, but it hadn't been finished. And I eventually got to the right Alton, about 30 or 40 miles away the next day. But that was not much fun. But it was all part of what went on all the time, I suppose. That it certainly taught me a lesson. We did sleep in some awful places, incidentally, when we on some of these trips. Now, when we came to the invasion, that was a big radio countermeasures exercise, and of course, the invasion was a very, very secret affair. And all of us had a little part of it, and even in Bob Coburn's group, Martin's Rouse's group, none of us really knew what the others were doing. We all kept to it. We didn't gossip amongst ourselves what each other was doing. And my job was to install a lot of equipment in. I think we installed these in fortress aircraft for jamming the enemy ground-to-air radio communications, so that we could put a total blanket across the invasion area and Calais, so that there was no, you know, so that the enemy fighters were completely blanked out from contact with the ground and vice versa. And all I didn't even, I mean, except for guessing, one didn't even know that this was for the invasion. You only guessed that, but the job was to install the aircraft, get all these aircraft fitted up to jam ground-to-air communications to the enemy. That was my job. Another mate of mine, about five or six of us all lived as bachelors in one household. And another guy, who is now a retired professor in Western Australia, David Alan Williams, his job was to install this moonshine gear in motor torpedo boats.
Moonshine?
Yeah. The thing that made one aircraft look like a lot. Didn't I mention it was called moonshine? I should have mentioned it was called moonshine. That was the code name for it. He installed that into motor torpedo boats, so that when motor torpedo boats were driven across the channel, they looked like a great fleet. And they had also simple little things on them, like great big record players, which at an appropriate moment played recordings of the fleet dropping anchor, so that motor torpedo boats would look like a fleet going across the channel. Now, of course, that worked all right for the Freya radars, but they had to make sure that it worked for all the radars as well. And so there was another guy who worked out very complicated patterns for the aircraft to fly throwing out window. But that was a tremendous effort by everybody. But still, you know, I had one little bit of it, and other people had other little bits of it. Now, that, of course, it still continued, all the bombing raids that, and the protection of the bombers, that went on and on and on. And that was a continuous effort. Then came the great crisis of V2. And we knew the V2 was going to come. In fact, it was fairly common knowledge that there was a secret weapon coming. But we knew roughly what it was. And Martin Ryle... Now, and we also knew that it would be radio-controlled and therefore be pretty accurate when it hit the ground.
Is this V1 or
no, V2? No, V2. We knew it would be radio-controlled and accurate when it hit the ground. Now, don't tell me it wasn't, because I'll tell you why in a minute. We also, and don't ask me how it happened, after a bit we had all the radio and electronic gear that was going to go into the V2, we had it in the lab. So we got all the bits and pieces, and we were told, jam it. Well, there was a major problem, because although I said we had all the bits and pieces of the radio control gear, there was one vital piece missing, which told us what frequencies they were going to use. We could guess a certain amount, but the vital piece, there's a vital bit missing. Now, we were told that when all this kit had left Stockholm or wherever, it was complete. But when it arrived in our lab, it was incomplete. So there was that mystery. Somebody had nicked it. So you never quite knew what was going on around you half the time. Anyway, Martin Ryle did a marvellous piece of detective work. I didn't know he was doing it. He just disappeared, and he was out on the East Coast, I believe, I don't know the full story, listening and studying all the transmissions from Peenemünde and the other likely launching sites. And maybe just Peenemünde, I don't know. And he deduced from all these from what he heard, how the thing would work. From what he'd heard and the bits and pieces we have, we could then piece together the whole system. And it was very, very clever. There were two bands of frequencies used. Now, I may not have got these accurate, but they were round about 40 megacycles. Let's say 35 to 45 megacycles. And another band of frequencies which were twice that plus 4. In other words, 35 to 45, it would be 74 to 94. Those two bands of frequencies. And when Martin observed that these two bands of frequencies were full of radiation, CW radiation, continuous wave radiation, he also observed that, he deduced from that and from the gear that we had, that all those signals were, except for some special ones, were just to kid us. They weren't doing anything at all. But amongst them all, there would be some which did have the exact relationship of F and 2F plus 4, like the ones, say, there'd be one at 40 and one at 84. And it was the combination of those two which actually would control the V2. All the rest were of no interest. Now, by doing that, the Germans presented us with an impossible problem, they thought. Because to jam those whole bands would have required an enormous amount of power. We couldn't have done it. We'd have required so many aeroplanes carrying so much gear, it would be impossible. But if we could just find out the individual one that was being used, the 40 and 84, if we could detect that one, and that would only come up when the thing was launched, if we could find it quickly and jam those two immediately, then we'd be onto a good thing. Yes, we knew if we could detect the 40 and the 84, or whatever it was, as soon as the V2 had taken off, then we could tune our jammers immediately to those two frequencies, and we'd have got them before they could have controlled the missile on its homing in on upward to land in the place they wanted. And we devised a very special jammer and a very special receiver such that we could automatically scan for whenever there was this combination of F and 2F plus 4. And as soon as we saw that, we just tuned to it, threw a switch, and the jammer was on. And we thought we were in a marvellously good, healthy state. Well, there were very, very strange coincidences because I remember that there was great euphoria when Montgomery swept up through Antwerp, and it looked as though the war was going to be over within a day or two. And we thought, oh, well, that's, it's all over, fine. And at that time, just about that time, at the height of the optimism of it all finishing in a week, there was a grand, big meeting at the Air Ministry on the plans for all this jamming of the V2. It's a big meeting, and I remember I represented our scientific part of it. Going up there, I'd driven up there in a little RAF van thing, went to the meeting at the Air Ministry or wherever, and afterwards I was going to go on to the squadron where we were steadily getting ready for operations. Well, at this meeting, the chairman, who was, I've forgotten his name now, but he later became chairman of the Lex City Board, Sir Robert Rennick, he was so full of enthusiasm for the end of the war, he cancelled everything. The whole countermeasures to V2 were cancelled there and then at that meeting. I thought, and the war's going to be over. He said, be finished tomorrow. Of course, it wasn't finished about another year, but there we are. So I thought, well, now what am I going to do? Am I going to go up to the squadron? I thought, well, if the war's going to be over, good place to be would be all these guys on this squadron. They'd have such a hell of a party, we might as well go. So I started driving out of London up north towards the whatever field it was, I can't remember which. And as I was driving out of London, there was a hell of an explosion. And my little Hillman convertible RAF car thing was blown across the road and fortunately landed on four wheels again. But I thought, my God, what the hell was that? And anyway, I drove on up to the squadron and thought no more about it. There was no party going on. I thought, oh, well, the war won't be over till tomorrow, they'll have a party then. So I went to bed.